Gives me a tremendous pleasure to welcome everybody to what has become, I think, already 7 or 8 years of the annual pre-Shavuos lecture series, Shiurim, that we've hosted here at the Yeshiva. I want to begin by asking everyone to please turn off your cell phones so that we're not interrupted in the middle of the Shiur. I also want to begin by giving a special thanks to the sponsors of tonight's Shiur. Tonight's Shiur is dedicated by Project Chazon, and also dedicated by the Pienko family in honor of Binyamin Baruch Zev's upcoming graduation, in honor of the yard side of Rina Liba Bas Moshe Halevi, the birth of Rina Ega, to Yocheved and Dov Feinerman, the second birthday of Yaakov Pienko, and also in memory of Yaakov Ben Shmuel. We thank the Pienko family very, very much for dedicating. I remember a while ago I was friendly with an Avreich, a young married man who studied at the Mir Yeshiva. And he was telling me the difference between the Mir, in his eyes, the difference between Mir and Panovich in Israel. So he said, in Panovich, they open up your mind. In Mir, they open up your eyes. That's what he was saying. And when I think of Rabbi Forman's reputation in terms of his ability to analyze passages, particularly in Chumash and in the Navi, I think of that as well. That many of us may have learned many of the parts of the Chumash and Navi many times. We may have heard the story many times. But I think listening to a shiur from Rabbi Forman, it has that quality of opening up our eyes to the text, to the ideas, even many things that we've known before. After you hear it from Rabbi Forman, you realize that there was so much there that you didn't know before you heard him. And it's a great pleasure, a kavod, and a schus for us to welcome Rabbi Forman to our Beis Medrash. We thank him very much for coming. Please give your undivided attention to Rabbi David Forman.
Guys, but I just need the
this guy here. Mic up with you.
Okay.
All right. You good? Maybe just over.
There we are.
We can move this guy. This is it. Y'all good?
Let's see. Okay. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Does the microphone work? You can all hear me in the back, more or less. Okay, fantastic. Okay, it's terrific to see you all. Shavuos is around the corner, so I thought we would talk about kind of an introduction to Megillas Rus. What you have up under your screen looks nothing like Megillas Rus, you may have noticed. However, what I'm going to do tonight is really what you might call a very macroscopic introduction to Megillas Rus. We're going to go back and look at Megillas Rus in the context of the very broad scope of Jewish history, going back all the way to the beginning and progressively moving forward. So for the next few minutes, I'd like you to forget about Megillas Rus and to join me on a journey towards the very beginning of our history, where it begins, as we know, with pretty much Lech Lecha. It is strange because when we begin teaching our children in school, often, I don't know if they do this in DRS land, but often when we first begin to teach our kids in, first grade or kindergarten when they learn Chumash, we often start with Lech Lecha. But there's something very counterintuitive, if you think about it, with starting with Lech Lecha. Imagine starting a kid off, teaching him his very first psukim, his very first moments of Jewish knowledge, are these verses. Put yourself into the kid's shoes. You're a kid. You don't know anything. You're just starting to learn, right? Here's the first thing you hear. Once upon a time, Vayomer Hashem el Avram, God appeared to Avram and said, Lech lecha me'artzecha mi'oladecha mi'beis avicha la'aretz asher ereka. Go, leave your house behind. Go to the land that I'll show you. Ve'escha l'goy gadol, I'll make you into this great nation. Ve'varechecha, I'll bless you. Agadlo shmecha, I'll make your name great. You'll be terribly famous. Ve'yebracha, and it'll be blessing through you. Ve'avarecha me'varechecha me'kalecha or ve'nivruchu b'cha kol mishpachos ha'adamah. Through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So if you're a kid, what question might you have? Right? Very first words, no introduction. Right? You're learning your psukim, go home, you review them. If you had enough guts, what would you ask your Rebbe? What would you ask your mom? What would you ask your older brother? What question kind of, I mean, what's the deal? Try to put yourself in the shoes of little kid. Anybody? Who is this guy, right? I mean, who is, right? I don't know anything about this man. This is my first introduction to a man called Avram. And the first thing I hear, I don't know anything about him, no context, the first thing I hear is that God appears to him out of the blue and says, you're it. I'm going to bless you. You're going to be famous. You're going to start a whole new nation. The blessings come to the world. Like, if I'm a kid, I think, gee, I mean, Avram just kind of out of the blue. Maybe this could happen to me one day, right? You know, God appears to me, tells me, Yahweh, I mean, I don't know. It seems very strange. To me, this is almost one of the great questions in all of Sefer Bereishis. Great questions in all of Sefer Bereishis is, who is this person? We seem to get no introduction to Avram. He seems to just leap out of the blue, almost out of nowhere. And there's this man who at the very beginning of our getting to know him gets this incredible promise by HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he is going to be the one to save the world, that bracha is going to come to the world through him. He's going to foster this great nation. He's going to be famous. Everything is going to happen through him. Who is this man? Why do we get no introduction to Avram? Like, why couldn't the Chumash maybe spare one verse? You know, Noah. We don't get much of an introduction to Noach, but we get an introduction to Noach. What do we hear? Right? Noach, Ish Tzadik Haya B'dor Asav, Es Elokim Yitzhalech Noach. That's enough. Noach was a good guy, right? He was an Ish Tzadik. He walked with God. That's it. That's fine. I don't need to know details. Just give me that much. Why don't I at least hear that much about Avram? Right? Once upon a time, there was a man named Avram. He was a really good person. He was a Tzadik. He walked with God, and then maybe give me this. Then, right, makes sense. But there's no introduction. Question number one, why is there no introduction to Avram? How come he just seems to appear out of the blue? Now, the truth is, what I've just said is not true. There is an introduction to Avram. It's just we never teach it to our kids. We start learning at Lech Lecha, but that's actually not where the Chumash starts with Avram. There's six psukim right before Lech Lecha where we actually get introduced to Avram. So that's very exciting. We ask ourselves, well, why don't we start there? We should start teaching our kids from the six psukim before Lech Lecha. How come we do not teach our kids the six psukim before Lech Lecha? Do you ever wonder this? Why do we not learn that with our kids? This is where Avram gets introduced. I will tell you what I think off the record. Too many microphones for off the record. But if we can pretend this is off the record, what I would say is the reason why we do not teach our kids these six psukim is because they're too boring. If we started there, we would be afraid that kids would get too bored, right? And they wouldn't go on. Because what happens in those six psukim? If you look at the six psukim, nothing seems to happen. We seem to get these details about Avram's life that seem almost trivial. We hear about his brothers, we hear about who his brothers married and their travels and where they went and this one and that one. We hear about people like Nahor and like Milcah and like Yiska and people who we seem to never really meet again. And it just, and they're confusing psukim. And so we just don't teach them to our kids. So The second question is, if the Torah is really going to devote six psukim towards introducing Avram, why those six psukim? You know, if I had six psukim to introduce Avram, and this was the father, you know, the person who was most central in the entire book of Bereishis, I would have devoted a lot of time to, I would have, you know, I could have said a lot in six psukim. I could have said, I could have told the whole story of, you know, of Avram and the idols, right? Avram smashing the idols. As a matter of fact, right, when we do talk to our kids, when we give our kids background, so we say, well, who was Avram? So what do we always tell them? We tell them the story. Well, Avram went in the Kivshan Ha'esh, he went in the furnace, he smashed the idols of his father. There were the big idols, there was the little idols. Very entertaining story. Problem is, it's not in the Bible, right? It's not there in Chumash. Why does the Chumash ignore, if it, you know, very important story, but it's only there in the Medrash. It's not in those six psukim that introduce Avram. So how do we understand, A, you know, why Avram just seems to appear on the scene with no introduction, and B, why this introduction, these strange six psukim? So tonight, I want to focus with you on these six psukim that we usually ignore. Okay? We have to back up. They're right over here. Okay? And kind of let's read through this. As we read through this, just be conscious what sort of questions seem to emerge. All right? What are the issues that seem to emerge as we go through these six psukim? Okay, here we go. Ela Toldos Terach. These are the generations of Terach. Terach, Halidas Avram. Terach gave birth to Avram, Es Nachor, Ves Haran. Terach gave birth to Nachor, Avram rather, Nachor and Haran. So, your first quiz of the evening. How many siblings? There's two siblings. How many siblings altogether? We've got three brothers, right? Who are they? Ready? Three brothers are Avram. Say this along with me, everybody. Nachor and Haran. That was much too quiet. All together now. Ready? Avram, Nachor, and Haran. Very good. We're going to test you on that later. You must not ever forget this. This is very important. Got to keep your eye on the ball and follow what happens here. So, first thing we know, three siblings. Avram, Nachor, and Haran are all children of Terach. Then, Haran halides Lot. The Haran halides Lot. Haran gives birth to Lot. Question number one. Anybody? How come we mention Lot here, right? So the pasuk seems to be devoted to telling us the first generation progeny of Terach. That would be Avram, Nachor, and Haran. All of a sudden, we get one grandchild mentioned, the child of Haran. A little strange. Anyway, moving on. What's that? Yes, it is. We'll get to that later. Vayomas Haran al pnei Terach aviv, be'eretz molatato burakastim. So Haran dies al pnei Terach aviv, in the presence of Terach, his father. That, by the way, is the point in which Rashi comments and tells you about the whole story of, which you're familiar with, I assume the story of the fiery furnace, Avram going into furnace, because the drash is that Vayamas Haran al pnei Terach aviv doesn't just mean that Haran died in the lifetime of his father, but that he died because of his father. His father was indirectly responsible for the death of Haran, and so Rashi tells you the story. Once upon a time, they were in the idol store, and Avram and Haran went to work and destroyed all the idols, and Terach came home, and they were told upon Terach gave them over to the authorities, and they were eventually thrown in the furnace. Avram survived, but Haran didn't. Basically, Haran said, if Avram goes in the furnace, comes out alive, I'll go in too. If he comes out dead, then I'm not going in. Avram came out alive, but Haran didn't. So, that's the story. But whatever the case is, Haran dies al pnei Terach aviv beres molatto, when his father is in the lifetime of his father in Ur Kasdim. Okay, now we get to the confusing part. What we're about to read now is the pasuk that I believe is the reason why we never teach this to our kids. Because the pasuk which we're about to read is so confusing that by the time you're done with this pasuk, you just say, what happened? and you say, like, whatever, let's just go to Lech Lecha. Right? Lech Lecha is right around the corner. Let's just ignore this, right? So here's the pasuk. We're just going to read it through. Note its confusing properties. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lahem nashim. Avram and Nachor then take wives. Shem Eshes Avram Sarai. The name of Avram's wife is Sarai. Vashem Eshes Nachor. And the name of Nachor's wife was Milcah. Milcah, the daughter of Haran. Avi Milcah v'Avi Yiska, the father of Milcah and the father of Yiska. You guys all got that? No. Right? That was very confusing. All right, so we're going to come back to that confusing pasuk. We're going to try to understand exactly what happened there. But basically, some people married these wives. Vati Sarai akara ein lavalad. And Sarai, who was the wife of Avram, was an akara ein lavalad. Any questions? A, it's repetitious. B,
so far
none of them had kids. But we're just being told more than the fact that she can't have kids, that she doesn't have kids. We're also being told that she can't have kids. So, question is, I'll tell you my question. My question is, I would say that this is a terrible invasion of Sarai's privacy. Wouldn't you think? I mean, think about it. You just met her, and the very first thing you're told about her is that she can't have children. I mean, why do I need to know this now? If you think about this in the larger context of Chumash, when does this fact become relevant, that Sarai can't have kids? Much later. Maybe later on, when she gives Hagar because she can't have kids. That's when I need to know that. So why can't I wait till there? Why is this, like, the very first piece of information? You interrupted a story. I don't know anything about Sarai. I don't know anything about anything. And I have to hear that she can't have children. It just seems like an irrelevant detail plopped into the middle of the story. What's it doing here? All right, moving on. Vayikach Terach Zavram Beno, Ves Lot Ben Haran Ben Beno, Ves Sarai Kalaso, Eshes Avram Beno, Vayetsu Ita Murakastin. So Terach then takes Avram, Lot and Haran, Lot, the child of Haran, right, and Sarai, and leaves Ur Kasdim to go to Canaan, and he gets until Haran, Vayesh Usham. He gets until Haran, and he stops there. All right? Vayi me Terach Hamesh Shanim Matayim Shana, Terach lived for a while, Vayamas Terach B'Haran, and Terach died in Haran. All right, that's the story. At face value, it just appears to be a bunch of travel trivia, a bunch of trivia about who married who, when, and where, and they died, and this and that. But again, these are people we seem to never meet again. It just, what's going on here? Why is this so important to know? Why is this the introduction to Avram? So I'd like to read the story through with you one more time, and this time, actually follow the ball, and try to answer our questions. We have a few questions. We want to know what Lot was doing in there. We want to know just how these details hang together. How does the story hang together? What was all that confusing stuff with the wives in the middle? And what's the point of this story? The argument I want to make to you tonight is that in this travel trivia lies a hidden story. There is a story here. And the story is actually the perfect introduction to Avram. It's there because it's what we need to know to perhaps understand why Avram was chosen. Why was this man chosen? Who was he? It's here in this story. So let's try and look at the story and keep our eye on the ball and figure it out. I just came from Manhattan. As you know, if you walk the streets of Manhattan, there is a game that is played often on the streets of Manhattan called Three Card Monty. In Three Card Monty, there's these three cards. There's this little mark under one of them. And they make a lot of money conning people because you have to keep your eye on the card that has the thing and you bet the money and you lose the money. That's basically the way it works. The Torah, in essence, is playing three-card Monty with us in this story. There is a shell game going on in one of these psukim. You have to keep your eye on the ball. If you keep your eye on the ball, the story will begin to look different. So let's read it one more time. This time maybe we'll do it in PowerPoint. Okay, the Torah introduces Avram. So in our yellow pit section of text up there, we get the birth of Avram, Nahor, and Haran, the three children of Terach. So remember, Terach has three children, Avram, Nahor, and Haran. And, let's see if we can find our cursor. Here we go. Haran Halidat Lot, we have that sort of strange thing. We hear about Haran giving birth to Lot. Why do we have this information? But let's get back to the text. Now, Vayamas Haran al Pnei Terach Aviv. Haran dies. Who was Haran again? Haran was one of the three sons. Remember? Who are the sons? Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran is one of the sons. So Haran dies. Vayamas Haran al Pnei Terach Aviv Beretz Canaan. Now, we also learn that Haran not only dies, but he dies at a young age. How do we know that? Because he dies when his father is still alive. So he dies, he predeceases his father. Okay. Now we get to the part where it's easy to lose the trail. Okay, so let's pay attention to what happens. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lahem nashim. Avram and Nachor take wives. Now, who do they take as wives? Well, we're told who they marry. The name of Avram's wife, right, is Sarai. That's all we know about her. Now, who is Nahor's wife? Shem Eshes Nahor, the wife of Nahor, is Milcah. And who is Milcah? Milcah is Bas Haran. Okay? Milcah is the daughter of Haran. Now, what does that mean? That means that Milcah, right, is actually the niece of Nahor, but who was Haran? Let's remember who Haran was. Who was Haran? The brother. Which brother was Haran? The brother that just died. So, right, let's just figure out what happened. There was a brother who died, and immediately after that brother died, Haran, all of a sudden Avram and Nahor decide to take wives, and Nahor decides to marry the daughter of the deceased brother. Okay? Now, Milcah just happens to be the daughter of Haran, but Bat Haran Avi Milcah, Haran is the father of Milcah, but, the Torah tells us, he's also Avi Yiscah, the father of another daughter by the name of Yiscah. Milcah has a sister by the name of Yiscah. Now, Chazal tell us something about Yiscah. We never hear of Yiscah ever again in the Torah. Chazal, however, identify her. What do Chazal tell us about Yiscah? Sarai. Chazal say that Yiscah was the code name, as it were, for Sarai. Very strange. Why do they say this? And how do they know this? So let's focus on this. Why do Chazal say that Yiscah was in fact Sarai? And how do they know that Yiscah was in fact Sarai? Let's figure it out. Now, what's going on here? Right after we heard that Haran dies, one of the surviving brothers, a guy by the name of Nahor, just happens to reach out and marry his daughter. Why would he do that? So let's just think about this for a moment. Let's just sort of free associate. Think Sefer Dvarim for a moment. Is there any halacha in Sefer Dvarim that comes to mind that sounds kind of like this? Yibum, you all say. And Yibum is in fact correct. What is Yibum? Yibum, of course, is, Levirate marriage in English, is basically this idea that when brothers are together and the wife of one brother dies before his time, dies young, and they don't have kids, so there's a mitzvah upon the brother of the deceased to marry the widow. What's the point? What does the Torah give as a rationale for the mitzvah of Yibum? What's supposed to happen? They're supposed to have kids. And the kids that they have, right, lo yimache shmo miYisrael, so that his name does not get rubbed out of Israel. The child of the new couple, of the brother of the deceased and the widow, is called after or is seen as the spiritual legator, the spiritual legacy of the deceased brother. If you think about it, it is... Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Okay, we'll get to this more in a moment. But our case is not exactly Yibum, but it is similar to Yibum. How is it similar to Yibum? There's a man who dies before his time, and immediately after that, brothers jump in and marry a girl from the family, right? Not the widow in this case, the daughter, but it sounds enough like Yibum that it sort of seems like a proto-Yibum, some kind of attempt to perpetuate the legacy of the deceased. We have evidence of other proto-Yibum cases in Sefer Bereishis. What one comes to mind? The story of Yudin Tamar. Yudin Tamar ultimately is also a case of Yibum. It's a proto-Yibum case. You can look at the Ramban there. The Ramban talks about this. And the Ramban, basically what happens in Yudin Tamar is that there was supposed to be, remember, all of this is before Matan Torah. So this is before the halacha of Yibum is actually ever given in Sefer Dvarim. But it seems that even in Bereishis, the idea of Yibum was known even before the law of Yibum was given in the Torah. And the Ramban says in the story of Yudin Tamar that Yibum before Matan Torah was a more expansive idea than after Matan Torah. After Matan Torah, the idea of Yibum contracted so that it only applied in certain situations, in situations where there was no child, no child at all, where there was a brother of the, where there was a brother of the deceased who could marry the widow and only the widow. But before Matan Torah, before the Torah was given, the Ramban says, the law of Yibum was more expansive, such that Tamar's ultimate union with Yehuda, who was her father-in-law and not her brother-in-law, was also deemed to be a sort of proto-Yibum, a Yibum-like thing. It was a woman marrying a man from the family of the deceased to try to perpetuate the name. It seems like something like this was going on. And if you think about Chazal identifying Yiska with Sarai, they seem to have this in mind too. Because think about it. What are the consequences of saying that Yiska was in fact Sarai? Who's Yiska? Yiska is a sister of Milcah. Remember, Haran, who is dead, has two daughters, Milcah and Yiska. Now we know that Nahor marries Milcah. We also know that Avram marries Sarai. Right? In saying that Sarai is in fact Yiska, what are Chazal really saying? They were saying that it wasn't just Nahor who performed Yibum, as it were. It was also Avram. Avram and Nahor married sisters, the two sisters, the two daughters of their deceased brother, in an attempt to have children from them that would perpetuate the name. That seems to be where the Chazal are coming from. Now, I'm going to play skeptic for a moment. Here's my skeptical hat. If I am a non-frum guy or something like that challenging the authority of Chazal, here's what I would say. Those rabbis, they're always out to make Abraham look good, right? Here the Torah comes and says that Nahor was doing this meritorious act. He married the sister of the daughter of his deceased brother. But Avram just married somebody else, Sarai. But then those rabbis came along, and they actually said that Sarai was in fact Yiska, somebody we don't know anything about, and they did it just to make Avram look good, right? How did Chazal know this? If you're talking with some guy on the plane who makes that argument to you, we'll call him Joe on the plane, my perpetual friend. So what would you say to Joe on the plane, right? Are the rabbis really trying to make Avram look good, or do they have any evidence to support the notion that Yiska might in fact be Sarai? So let's look at some evidence for a moment. I want to take you back to this story. I'm going to go back to our Lech Lecha page for a moment. I'm sorry. It is over here. There is a grammatical oddity that I want you to pay attention to. It's right over here. Let me see if I can block this and show it to you without messing everything up. There's something grammatically wrong with this phrase. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lehem nashim. And that's right. And Avram and Nachor took wives. You with me? Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lehem nashim. How many people are taking wives? Two. If two people are taking wives, what's wrong with Vayikach? Should have been Vayikhu. So how come it's Vayikach? Good question. Glad you asked. Turns out, that there is another time in Bratius where this exact same thing happens. That's right. The other time this happens is actually 30 psukim before this. It is in the story of Noach and the vineyard. In the story of Noach and the vineyard, we have this same strange oddity where two people do something, as a matter of fact, they're taking, and there's still a singular taking for something they're both doing together. Let's go back for a moment and look at that story, because it's kind of relevant. It's the story of Shem and Yefes. You can find it right over here. And basically, it's the story of Noah and the vineyard. Basically, what happens is this. So, Vayu b'nei Noach hayotzim min ha-teva, there were children of Noah that came out of the teva, Shem, Cham, and Yefes. Right? Shem, Cham, and Yefes. V'cham hua b'knan. And Cham was the father of Canaan. So as a man, Noach, he's got three children, Shem, Cham, and Yefes. And Cham is the father of Canaan. By the way, does this remind you of anything? This sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Because we were just talking about a man and three children. Terach and three children. And remember how Terach had three children and Haran, one of those children, had another child. And it was strange that child got introduced. Well, look what's happening over here. There's three children. And one of them, like, has a child, Cham, the father of Canaan. It's kind of odd. Anyway, Shlosha Ela B'nei Noach, these three children were the sons of Noach. And from there came the whole world. Vayachal Noach ish adama vayitakerem. So Noach then goes and begins something. Let's not get into what he begins exactly. He plants himself a vineyard. He gets himself drunk. Becomes naked in his tent. And Cham, the father of Canaan, sees the nakedness of his father and tells his two brothers outside. But the two brothers, instead of joining Cham in sort of ridiculing their father, actually go to save the father. Vayikach Shem vayefes es asimla. Vayasimu al Shem shnehem. Vayelchu achronis. Now this is the pasuk where we have that grammatical oddity. You get it? Vayikach Shem vayefes es asimla. Shem and Yefes together, they take this cloak and they cover their father. But there's two people taking the cloak. It should have said vayikchu. You ready? Should have said vayikhu. Vayikach Shem vayefes asimla. So Shem and Yefes took this cloak and they placed it on their shoulders, al Shem shnehem. Vayelchu achronid. They went backwards and they covered the nakedness of their father and they didn't see their father's nakedness. And Noach wakes up, figured out what Canaan did to him. Arur Canaan, he curses Canaan. Evad avadim yelachav, he says that Canaan should be a servant to his other brothers. He blesses Shem. Yavt Elohim liyefes vayishkon ba'olei Shem. He grants Yefes beauty and says the beauty of Yefet will dwell in the tents of Shem. And Noach dies at the end of the story. Okay, that's basically the story. Now, in this story, Rashi is bothered by the grammatical oddity that we noted. Rashi asks the question, Vayikach Shem Vayefes as a simla. Why does it say Vayikach Shem Vayefes as a simla? Should have said Vayikhu. What is Rashi's answer? There is an interesting book out there called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. Anyone read it? It's a book about grammar. It's actually a humorous book about grammar. It is a comedy book about grammar. You might have thought that there could be no such thing as a comedy about grammar, but it is a comedy about grammar. The title takes its name from a joke about a large panda that walks into a bar and eats, shoots, and leaves. You get it? It depends where you put the comma, right? Is it eats, comma, shoots, comma, and leaves? If that's what it means, he walked into the bar, he ate something at the bar, he shot the bartender, and he left. But there's another possibility without the commas, which is what do pandas do? They eat, shoots, and leaves, right? So the comma can change the whole meaning of the sentence. In our story, too, the comma changes the whole meaning of the sentence. And this is Rashi's point. Rashi, in effect, says, it depends where you put the comma. And the Torah is telling you where to put the comma. Think about it. What's the logical way to resolve this grammatical problem? Vayikach Shem Vayefes as a simla. There's an easy logical way out. There are two people doing something, but it's only singular. A comma. How would a comma solve the problem? Where would the comma go? Right after Shem. If you put a comma after shame, you solve the problem. Watch. Vayikach shame, comma, vayefet et asimla. What does it mean? And shame took the cloak along with yefet. Do you understand? The pasuk in a subtle way is suggesting what about the relationship between shame and yefet? Who is the instigator? Shame. The singular vayikach is telling you that the first person named is the instigator. Whatever they were doing together, but it was Shame's idea and Yefet tagged along. That's what the singular vayikach is doing. Now, let's go back to our story and apply that lesson. Here is our story. Immediately after the death of Haran, the two brothers spring into action. What? It's not our story?
Go back six
psukim. Here's our story. Immediately after the death of Haran, so, Vayikach Avram v'Nachalehem Nashim, two brothers spring into action. What are they doing? You see from Nachor what they're doing. They're marrying nieces. But, Vayikach Avram v'Nachalehem Nashim, a singular Vayikach, followed by Avram. Where's the comma? After Avram. It's Vayikach Avram, comma, Vin Nachor Lehem Nashim. Whatever they're doing, Avram's the instigator. What are they doing? They're marrying nieces. We know that Milcah has a sister by the name of Yiska. Right? By the way, what does Milcah mean? Milcah sure sounds a lot like what? Malka, queen. Yiska, from the language Rashi says of Nasicha. Nasicha means princess. Princess and queen. Very interesting name for these two girls, princess and queen. What would you say the difference between a princess and a queen is? One is younger and one is older, almost like one is a young girl and one is a mature woman. Who is the one who can bear children? Milcah. Who is the one who can't? The princess, almost like a girl that is too young yet to bear children, right? Yiska. But also something interesting, Sarai. What does the name Sarai mean? Also princess. Yiska and Sarai, Rashi points out, really mean the same thing. So Chazal are coming from somewhere. Chazal seem to suggest that the grammar of the verse seems to argue that Avram was the instigator. It was Avram's idea. But, right, what were they doing? They were marrying nieces. They were marrying the two daughters of the deceased. Why were they doing it? To perpetuate the name of their dead brother. Batisara akara in la balad. That verse now makes sense. How? Because if the whole point of what they were doing was to perpetuate the names of the deceased brother by virtue of having children with girls in their family, what is the Torah telling you when it's telling you Batisara akara in la balad, that Sarah could not have a child? That Avram might have had good intentions, but it couldn't be fulfilled. And this sets up the whole tension in the Avram story, which is what's going to happen. He's trying to have this child. He's trying to do this Yibum for his brother, but he can't. So what's going to happen? What's going to be with Sarai? Vayikach Terach as Avram b'no. At this point, Terach takes Avram, and Lot, and Haran, and Sarai, and they all leave and they go to Canaan. Vayavoh ad Haran vayeshvu sham. They get as far as Haran Vayeshvusham. Vayeshvusham seems like very normal words that would appear anywhere. Turns out Vayeshvusham only appears twice in Chumash. Here and one other place. Anyone know what the other Vayeshvusham in Chumash is? It was about 30 psukim before this. It is in Migdal Bavel. In Migdal Bavel, they go from Kedem toward Eretz Shinar, Vayeshvu Sham, and they end up settling there. By the way, in Migdal Bava, what did God have against the tower? What did God have against the tower? What was wrong with the tower? Why did the people make the tower? Hava nimne lanu ir v'rosho b'shamayim v'nase lanu shame. Let's make a name for ourselves. The tower builders were out to make a name for themselves. They were so focused on their name, this narcissistic production of a tower that would embody their name, and God didn't like that. And as a result, God destroyed the tower and dispersed humanity. And in dispersing humanity, it was time for a game plan change. Why? Because until then, whatever happened with Noah and with Cain and with all the sins, humanity was one. There was only one nation, one people, and therefore Hashem could have a relationship with all of humanity. But in the wake of the tower, that there is a dispersal of nations and there are new languages and new nations, if you're God, what's your problem? How do I have a relationship with everyone anymore? There's not everyone. There's all these different nations. It's time for a new plan. What do you need? You need to do what? You have to start with a family, an individual, a family. Build that family up into a nation. Have a relationship with them, and then move on, and through that affect the rest of the world. There's only one problem. What would you worry about? If you're going to single out one nation, one man, and say it's you, I'm going to make your name great. And it's after the tower, when all people did was narcissistically focus on their own name, what might you worry about? What's the great challenge that that people must face? Their own narcissistic self-involvement. What if they think it's all about them? You're going to promote one guy and make him into a great nation to save the world? How do you know he won't become another tower builder? Vayeshvu sham. It's almost as if the challenge that faces Avram right now is whether he will become another tower builder. If you're a man, think about it. First of all, if you're God, why might you choose Avram? If you're worried about narcissistic focus on your own shame, who are you going to choose after the tower? What did Avram do? What did he do in the act of Yibum? What the act of Yibum is a sacrifice of your own name to carry on the name of someone else. It is surrogate parenthood. It's when you take the most important thing you have, your own child, your own legacy, and it's not your own child, your own legacy anymore. You're building someone else's name. It's the first great act of chesed. Hashem says, that's someone I can use. Let's start with that. The challenge, of course, for Avram is, will he continue with it? Or will he become a tower builder? What's the challenge? Once you realize, sir, I can't have children, if you're Avram, what might you be thinking? I tried, right? You know, a man has to worry about building his own name, right? And, you know, maybe it's time to try someone else. Maybe it's time to, the question is, will Avram become that? Will he change into that? But he doesn't. Hashem appears to him. Lech lecha. Keep on going. The journey was good. Eschal l'goy gadol, I'll make you into a great nation. Agadlah shemecha, I will make your name great. Through you, blessing will come. And what does Avram do? If you look at Avram in his early journeys, what is he doing all the time? Vayikra b'shem Hashem, vayiven sham mizbeach, l'Hashem ani ro'eh lav. Vayikra b'shem Hashem, over and over. I don't have it here, just a little bit further down. There it is. Right? And it keeps on going. Right? So, this seems to be the background in this story. Let me just go back to PowerPoint for 1 second with you. What's fascinating about this is that all of this seems to echo another act recorded earlier in the Torah. This whole story that we've developed has happened before. We've heard it before. Avram and Nahor seem to follow in the footsteps of two other brothers who performed their actions exactly 10 generations earlier. If we replay the story, every element of the story we heard in another story 10 generations ago. In our story, we hear about the toldos of Terach. We're introduced to a father and 3 sons. But the minute we meet one of the 3 sons, we're introduced to a grandchild, because that son himself has a child. The son who has that grandchild, then gets wiped out. He gets wiped out in the presence, al pnei his father. That's what happened to Haran. But the grandson, in this case Lot, is the one who bears the burden of the tragedy because he's an orphan. The grandfather, of course, bears some responsibility for the tragedy. Of course, remember Chazal, Haran was the one who told on, Terach was the one who told on Haran to Nimrod. Two remaining sons then jump in to try to rectify the damage. A singular verb, vayikach, is used to describe the act of both of them together. The story ends with the death of Terach, the death of the father figure. Every one of those things happened before in the story of Noah and the vineyard. Every last one of them, the story of Noah and the vineyard, also began with the toldot section, the toldot of Noah and the three sons. There was a father and three children, except there, the three children were Shem, Cham, and Yefet. The minute we met Cham, we're told that Cham was also the father of Canaan. Cham was cursed because he came to confront the nakedness of his father face to face, the same way that Haran was wiped out, Cham is wiped out. And who is responsible? Noah is responsible, the same way that Terach is responsible, because Noah is the one that curses Cham. After Cham is cursed in the presence of his father, two remaining children jump in, try to rectify the damage. The same singular verb, vayikach, is used to describe the act of Shem and Yefet trying to make things better. The family in the last story was headed toward Canaan. In our story, the story of Shem and Yefet, Canaan was the one who was cursed irretrievably. The story of Terach ends with the death of Terach, the father figure. The story of Noah ends with the death of Noah, the father figure. It seems like the same story, but there's only one difference, the basic contrast. The basic contrast revolves around exactly what Avram and Nahor did and how it was different than what Shem and Yefet did. Think about it. What does Shem and Yefet do? Shem and Yefet are focused on what? They're focused on saving who? On saving their father from shame, I don't mean, you get what I'm talking about. From disgrace. Thank you. I was looking for that word. Right? They can't help Chum's endangered legacy. They can't, right? On the other hand, Avram and Nahor, who are Avram and Nahor seeking to help? Right? They're seeking to help their brother, really. Right? They're seeking to help Haran. They're seeking to keep Haran's name going, stepping in where their dead brother can't. In the Noach story, we witness the loss of Cham's legacy. His shame is gone. He's not yet dead, but he might as well be. Cham is cursed. His name is endangered. In the Terach story, Haran is actually dead, but Nahor and Avram still succeed in building his shame. So it turns out there's a fascinating series of words that's right at the center of our story. I'm not going to do the chiasm with you. It's a little bit too complicated. It'll take a little too long. But just follow along with me right over here. Here's the Hebrew phrase for the idea that Shem and Yefet took the cloak and put it on their shoulders to cover their father. Vayikach Shem vayefes et asimla vayasimu al shem shnehem. Shem and Yefet took the cloak and they put it on their shoulders. I want you to meditate on that phrase for about 10 seconds. And I want you to look for patterns in that phrase. Look very carefully. Do you see any patterns? Any letter patterns, word patterns in that phrase? There you go. If you arrange it this way, it's a little easier to see. Vayikach Shem vayefes et asimla vayasimu al shem shnehem. Do you see it now? What about now? Look what's happening here. There's a shame in this story. And what's happening to it? First the Shin and Mem are together. And then the Shin and Mem are still together. But then there's the tiniest of letters, a Yud, right in between the Shin and the Mem. And then there's a larger letter, a Chaf, right in the middle between the Shin and the Mem. And then there's three whole letters between the Shin and the Mem. What is happening to the shame in this story? It is fraying. It is splitting apart. It's being destroyed. It is the silent scream of the destroyed shame. Right? Even as Shem and Yefet are acting, right, on behalf of their father, there is a shame that's being destroyed. Whose shame? It's the shame of Cham, their brother. They're not acting to help their brother. They're acting to help their father. Their brother is going down the tubes. It's being slowly pulled apart and lost. So although Shem and Yefes managed to safeguard their father's honor, there's nothing they can do for Ham. The legacy of a brother Ham is being pulled apart and destroyed. But 10 generations later, we encounter a very similar situation. There's a brother Haran, he's dead. His legacy, his shame is in danger of fading. But Avram and Nachor find a way to pull his shame together. They marry his daughters to perpetuate his legacy. Let's look at the pasuk that talks about Avram and Nachor helping the shame of their dead brother. See the pattern? Shin and Mem with two letters. Shin and Mem with just a yud. Shin and Mem. Shin and Mem. What's happening? There's a shame being rescued. A shame being pulled together. The exact opposite of what happened in the last story. The two stories contrast with each other, linguistically and conceptually. In one, there's a shame being destroyed. In another, a shame is being rebuilt. One final link between the two stories. There's two verbs in the story. Remember when Shem and Yefet took the cloak? Vayikach Shem Vayefet is similar, Vayasimu Ashkem Shnehem. Now you see that Vayikach and Vayasimu? Look at the same verse 10 generations later. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lehem nashim. Shem Eshes Avram Sarai. Shem Eshes Nachor Milka. There's a Vayikach, but there's no Vayasimu. Or is there? Can you find the hidden Vayasimu? Remember, the Torah doesn't have any vowelization. Read the words without vowelization and find the hidden Vayasimu. That's right. It's Nasim. It's right over there. The word Nashim, if you read it as Nasim, means let us place. It's as if as they're marrying wives, Nashim, what are they really saying? It's as if they're saying, Nasim shame, Nasim shame. We can do more than just place the cloak of 10 generations ago. We can replace the name. By marrying these wives, we can rebuild the name of Avram and Nachor. So, I'm sorry, rebuild the name, not of Avram and Nachor, I'm sorry, of dead Haran, right? Now, if we put this in larger context, we've seen how parallel events occur separated by 10 generations, Shem and Yefes, Avram and Nachor. Let's go further. What happened 10 more generations ago? 10 generations before Shem and Yefes. Is there another story that reminds you of this? Three brothers. Endangered legacy. What story am I talking about? It's the story of Cain and Hevel. 10 generations after the first man and woman, there too, there was a fading shame. Blood crying out from the ground, desperate to be heard. Who will save the blood of Cain? Of course it should fall to the brother. Who will save the blood of Hevel? Of course it should fall to the brother. But what's Cain's response? Hashomer achi anochi? That was the wrong response. Right, that was the wrong answer. Yes, of course you are the shomer. You have to do something, find a way to respond. Okay, so you can't bring him back to life, but worry about the loss of his shame. No, Cain doesn't care. Does anyone care? Does anyone help? Yes. Who helps rebuild the name of Cain? That's right. The person who helps rebuild the name of Cain is the father. Adam has another child. And what does he name that child? Shace. What does the name Shace mean? Kishos li Elokim zera acher tachas hevel ki arogo Cain. God has established another child. God has established another child to replace the replacement hevel. It's Yibum. It's the first Yibum in the Torah. But if you look carefully, you see a pattern. With Cain and Hevel, a brother never didn't act for a brother. He stood silently by, so a father acted instead, Adam Arisha. 10 generations later, a similar situation. A brother dies. Shem and Yefet, the remaining brothers, instead of acting to help their brother, they act to help their father. Do you see the connection? In each of these stories, brothers either... children help fathers, or fathers help children instead of brothers helping brothers. In each of these cases, the father acts for a son, or a son acts for a father, but a brother never acts for a brother until another 10 generations go by. 10 generations after Shem and Yefet, we meet Terach and his 3 sons, and for the very first time, brothers help brothers with Avram and Nahor, and that is where Avram is chosen. Now, we can play the game further, and with this I'll leave you. What happens 10 generations later? So far we've seen that acts separated by three different acts separated by 10 generations all seem to be repeating or building off of each other. So the next logical question is, what happens 10 generations later? We'll skip this, but is there anything about these events that remind you of things that happened 10 generations later? Time to do a little counting. Avram gives birth to Yitzchak, who gives birth to Yaakov, who gives birth to Yehuda, who gives birth to Peretz, to Chetzron, to Ram, to Aminadav, to Nachshon, to Salmon, who gives birth to Boaz. Welcome to Megillas Rus. You're wondering when we'd be getting back to the Guinness Mills. Everything that happened in these 3 stories happens again in Megillas Rus. And this is your homework. As you go through Megillas Rus, keep these 3 stories in mind. I'll start you off on this, right? But you can continue on this. Think of Megillas Rus in the context of these 3 stories. It's amazing. It's the same thing happening and culminating at even a higher level. We have a man and 3 sons in Avram and Haran, with Mahlon, Kilion, Boaz. We also have a man and 2 sons, Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion. Right? One of these, Elimelech, dies. Immediately after this, you'll have the same Vayikach Lehem Nashim. The same thing that you have in these stories. The 2 brothers, Mahlon and Kilion, spring into action immediately after the death of Elimelech, and they marry wives. There was only one problem. Who did they marry? They married Moabite wives. And in marrying Moabite wives, what did they do to the shame of their father? They destroyed it. It's the ultimate destruction. They're doing the exact opposite of everything that happened in the generations earlier. They're destroying the name rather than building it. Each wife is named. The shame of this one is Rus. The shame of that one is Orpah. Just like we have in the earlier story. One wife in the end can bear children. The other, Orpah, doesn't. Just like in our story here. Now, look at the yellow here. We have another Vayeshvu Shom, right? A family settles in Moab, outside of Israel, right? Vayeshvu Shom, family settles there, outside of Israel, in a place they'd originally only come to for a short period of time, right? Vayeshvu Shom, again, family settles in Moab, outside of Israel. They originally only came there for a short period of time. They got stuck there. And then, the yellow, after tragedy strikes, one of 2 surviving siblings, right? Keep your head on for this one, right? Haran is dead. One of 2 surviving siblings, Avram, along with his parent, Terach, leaving Nahor, the other surviving sibling, behind, heads off to Canaan with only the dimmest of chances of perpetuating the name of the dead relative because his wife, Sarai, can't have children. What does that remind you of in Megillas Rus? It's exactly the same thing in Megillas Rus. Tragedy strikes. Elimelech dies. One of 2 surviving wives of siblings, Rus, leaving behind Orpah, along with her mother-in-law, Naomi, just like in our story, there was the parent involved, heads off to Canaan, also with the same goal, perpetuating the name of the dead relatives. It's the same Yibum story, set up in almost exactly the same way. Of course, Mahlon and Kilion are doing the opposite of Avram and Nahor. They're destroying the legacy of their father. And you see it, right, with the Vayeshvu Shom. The Vayeshvu Shom in Rus really sounds a lot like Migdal Bavel. Who are Mahlon and Kilion interested in their own name, not in the name of their parents? It's all about their own name. It's the only thing that matters. It's just like the Tower Builders. It's just like Migdal Bavel. As a matter of fact, if you look at Migdal Bavel, you'll find a fascinating thing. If you compare the text of Migdal Bavel to the text of the Ruth prologue, you'll find that they both hover around the idea of shame. Here are all the shames in these stories. If you count them up, seven of them in each story, seven shames in the tower, seven shames in the Ruth prologue. But not only, right, not only that, of course, whenever you focus on your own shame, your efforts fail, the tower crumbles. Onan, later on, right, also focusing on his own shame, he's destroyed in the story of Yudin Tamar. In the story of Rus, Ploni Almoni, focusing on his own shame, doesn't want to do Yibam. What happens to him? He becomes Mr. Anonymous for generations. The Gemara, whenever he wants to refer to someone anonymous, it's Ploni Almoni. The guy who is worried about his own legacy has no legacy whatever in Jewish history. And of course, Machlon and Kilion, who are interested in their own name, what do their names mean? Machlon, sickness. Kilion, destruction. Strange name for two nice kids, right? Sickness and destruction. But that's their name. They're destroyed, right? So all of these people, their legacy is in danger of fading because they only looked after their own name. Here, by the way, are the seven instances of shame in the Ruth prologue. There are, however, other shin mem words in the Ruth prologue. If you put them in right where they belong, you find this, right? Again, the dividing shame in Sefer Rus. The very end of Rus, of course, Boaz and Ruth succeed in destroying the fraying shame. They bring back the shame of Elimelech, the shame of Machlon and Kilion. When they do, it's right over here, you'll find shame again all over the place. If you count up the shames at the end of Rus, you'll find seven of them. If you plot the seven on a graph, color code them, add in the shames, the other shin mem words where they belong, you'll find, again, a shame being restored, the shame coming back together. Bottom line is, Avram was promised there would be a time when he would be a great nation. And the epitome of that is Malachim Mechalatzecha Yetzeu. Kings will come to you. What's the problem with kings? Why in Sefer Shmuel is the Navi so worried about a king? What's the problem with having a king? You concentrate power in the name, in one person. What's that person going to think? It's all about him. So where are you going to choose kings from? What do you want to be the ground from which you choose kings? Yibam. People who can go beyond that. People who cannot look at their own shame. When it happened a fourth time, in the Sefer Rus, that's when kings could happen. That's when the nation, the promise of Avram, could finally be realized. If you look at our mission statement as a people, our mission statement is to be the people that care. If you think about chesed, what chesed is, Yibum is real chesed. How is Yibum chesed? Yibum is concentrated chesed. In focusing not on your own shame, but on the shame of others that are endangered. Who is the person who is closest to you in the world? Right? Your brother. What's the most precious gift you can give? Your own children. Who's the most vulnerable person in the world? Most vulnerable person in the entire world is a dead person. Dead people are very vulnerable. They still have interests, but they can't look after them. When the closest person in the world, your brother, is also the most vulnerable person in the world because he's dead and can't look after his own interests. And you give the most precious gift in the world, which is sharing your own shame, that is chesed par excellence. We think of Avram as a Baal chesed. His first act of chesed was that act of Yibum. That gave us a mission statement. What is our mission statement? Our mission statement is to be that kind of people that could be transparent, that can be Vayikra B'Shem Hashem, that can call in the name of others, that can build the name of others, that can build the name of God, and not focus obsessively on our own name. Anytime we say, nobody else matters, right? Woodmere matters, but nobody else matters. Brooklyn matters, but nobody else matters. The Jews matter, but the Goyim don't matter. Anytime you say, it's all about us, we fail. We focus on our name and saying it's all about us. It's not all about us. We were chosen because, paradoxically, it's not all about us. It's about our ability to be transparent and to build up that which is outside of us, and to reach out and to restore the name of God in the world, because we're not focused on our own fame and wealth and privileged status. That, I think, is the legacy of Avram and the legacy of Megillas Rus when you see it, I think, in the large picture. Have a great Shavuos.